Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People started disappearing.
The Guzman just fell out of a helicopter.
Uh-oh, what's going on here?
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC.
Money is very, very dangerous.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 30th of May, these are our main stories. A court in Hong Kong has found 14 people guilty of subversion in a huge case against pro-democracy campaigners in the territory. In Spain, Congress approves a controversial amnesty law for nationalists from the Catalonia region. We're in South Africa, where counting is underway in the country's elections. Also in this podcast, we'll head to Italy, where our correspondent reports on why the country has not totally broken from its political past. And
I'm Gillian. I'm from New Jersey, the US.
And why are you giving a tour of Harry Styles' hometown?
I've been a fan of his for 14 years, and I saw this job, thought it was my dream job, and I had to do it and give it a shot.
Pop star Harry Styles' home village in England puts on its own guided tours. We start in Hong Kong, where 14 pro-democracy activists have been found guilty of subversion back in 2021, among them two former legislators. More than 30 defendants had already pleaded guilty, and two others were acquitted. It's a landmark case that has swept up Hong Kong's best-known pro-democracy campaigners and effectively wiped out that entire movement. One of those acquitted, Lawrence Lau, gave this statement to reporters after leaving court.
I should not be the focus for today. I hope everyone will continue caring for other friends in the case. And if there needs to be a focus today, this judgment should be the focus. Today is only the end of a phase and the whole proceeding is ongoing, so I cannot say too much.
Emily Lau, the former chair of the Democratic Party of Hong Kong, told us her reaction to the verdict.
It's a very, very sad day for us, and many Hong Kong people are feeling very, very depressed. But of course, the fight goes on. Hong Kong is not dead, but I think some of those people will appeal, and we certainly would want to continue to fight for one country, two systems, the rule of law, independence of the judiciary. Today, the verdict is a big blow, and I saw many, many unhappy faces in court and outside court. So it's a very, very dark day for Hong Kong.
Well, to get more, I spoke to our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
As we just heard Emily Lau say, a very dark day for Hong Kong today. But it really goes back 5 years or even a bit longer when the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong was really strong. That was when you could see street demonstrations with up to 2 million people in the streets calling for stronger democracy in Hong Kong. We have to remember that Hong Kong back then was a quasi-democracy. It was part of Chinese territory, but it had its own political system. In 2019, there were local elections in which the pro-democracy candidates did really well, and I think that terrified Beijing. And then in 2020, Beijing imposed a national security law on Hong Kong. We've talked about it a lot. It basically outlawed dissent, outlawed anyone speaking out against the Hong Kong authorities or Beijing. But still, pro-democracy campaigners pushed ahead that same year, even though the national security law was in place. They decided to focus in on, again, on local elections in which they'd done really well in the past. And they held some informary primary elections to choose the best candidates they thought would do really well in local elections. Around 600,000 people voted in unofficial polls to choose those candidates. And that's really what they've been caught up on. Just after holding those informal polls, a few months later, there were dawn raids. That was in early 2021, and 47 people, 47 of the most high-profile pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong were swept up in those raids. Lawmakers, journalists, activists were all arrested, and they were accused of, because they participated in those informal primaries, the government argued that they were trying to strengthen the opposition so much that it could actually threaten the power of the state. And that's what they've really been hung up in this case. That's what it revolves around. So that's why today we've seen 31 of those 47 just plead guilty. That includes people like the high-profile student activist Joshua Wong, who really led pro-democracy protests. We've seen 14 people convicted today and 2 acquitted. So as Emily Lau said, a bit of a dark day for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong.
Celia Hatton. Spain's parliament has approved a controversial amnesty law for nationalists from the region of Catalonia. The bill, presented by the government of the socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, means legal action against separatist activity is withdrawn, and it will benefit several hundred Catalan nationalists. The Madrid region, controlled by the opposition, is likely to appeal the ruling. Speaking in Parliament, the leader of the Conservative People's Party, Alberto Núñez Feijóo, described the process to push for the law as corrupt.
You have lied to the Spanish people because you promised not to do what you are doing. You are turning the majority of Spanish people into second-class Spanish people. And yes, this bartering you are doing here has only one name. We have said it from the start: political corruption.
I spoke to Guy Hedgecoe in Madrid.
The law, as you mentioned there, lifts pending legal action against several hundred Catalan nationalists for separatist activity. The right-wing opposition is opposed to that law on principle. They say that it is giving preferential treatment to Catalans by lifting this legal action like this. But they also say that it's undemocratic, it goes against the spirit of Spain's democracy. And their other criticism is that the only reason that the socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez presented this law in the first place was that he needed the support in Parliament of Catalan nationalist parties who asked him for this law. So those are some of the criticisms. Mr. Sanchez, by contrast, has consistently argued that the amnesty is aiming to calm tensions in Catalonia, which had been running so high for so long because of efforts to break away from Spain. And he says that it's already on the way to achieving that aim.
And what will it effectively mean for Catalan nationalists?
Well, it affects different types of Catalan nationalists, if you like. I mean, a lot of the people who are going to benefit from it were people who were involved in the 2017 independence referendum, which was deemed illegal by the central government. So, for example, there might be civil servants or head teachers of schools who allowed their schools to be used for that illegal referendum, who have been facing legal action ever since then. That legal action is now lifted. But by contrast, there are also many politicians who've been facing more serious charges. The most high-profile beneficiary of this law will be Carles Puigdemont, the man who led that 2017 independence drive. He fled the country after that independence drive failed in 2017. He's been living abroad for the last 7 years. And it looks as if he will now return in the coming weeks because of this amnesty.
Guy Hedgecoe. Far-right parties are expected to make big gains in the European elections in just over a week's time. In Italy, the party of the Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, is topping the polls. It has roots in post-war fascism, but is moderated in office. As our Rome correspondent Mark Lowen reports, Italy allows ghosts from its past to haunt the present.
In Verona's football stadium, the fandom and the politics is hard line. At home to neighbouring Sassuolo, the ultras, Italy's fanatical supporters, control one end, and they've built a reputation.
As recently as December, these fans were suspended for a couple of matches due to racist chants. No sign of them today, and absent too are the swastika banners. But the stadia are where far-right politics has felt freest and where fascism has flourished.
At a recent team celebration, the leader of the ultras roared, "Who paid for this evening? Who gifted it to us?"
Adolf Hitler!
Prompting the cheer, "We're a fantastic team in the shape of a swastika. How great it is to be trained by Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess."
My name is Roberto Fiore. The National Secretary of Forza Nuova.
Italy's ultras are often part of extremist political groups, including Forza Nuova, a small but defiant party whose members have attacked migrants over the years. At the funeral of a party official, a swastika flag was draped over her coffin.
Are you a fascist?
I probably would say yes, but I have to complete the term and say I'm a revolutionary.
This was a regime that deported Jews to death camps, that put political opponents in internment camps. Are you honestly saying that you support those measures?
The internment camps are things that happen with the war. The Americans did it, the Germans did it, the Italians did it, and so on.
Signor Mussolini addressed more than 500,000.
It's over a century since the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini began his 2 decades of totalitarian rule. After he was killed in 1945, a neo-fascist party was allowed to form. It was sidelined until the 90s, when Silvio Berlusconi brought it into his governing coalition. Giorgia Meloni, Italy's current prime minister, started out in the neo-fascist youth. She has moderated, moving her party away from the far right, and is topping the polls before the upcoming European elections. But her critics say she still winks at her roots. Journalist Paolo Berizzi has been under police protection for the past 5 years after neo-fascist threats.
Il mondo neofascista italiano.
Far-right and neo-fascist groups felt legitimized with the Meloni government. She appointed ministers and even the president of the Senate who have a political background not unrelated to fascist nostalgia. Many leaders, including Berlusconi and Meloni, have tried to sanitize fascism. And in public opinion, it is no longer seen as the ugly and evil monster.
For many Italians, the fight against fascism is still central to their political purpose. In Bologna, historically the heart of anti-fascism, a teacher shows students a memorial to Italy's worst terror attack, bombings at the station in 1980 by neo-fascists that killed 85 people. The city's deputy mayor is Emily Clancy.
We're seeing things that are very similar to what happened at the beginning of fascism a century ago. Attacks on freedom of press, censorship, freedom for the LGBTQI community. The far right, not only in Italy but all over the world, is sort of trying to find a scapegoat for people's difficulties in everyday lives by attacking the migrant. To me, it's quite striking as being very close to fascism. It's again that same sort of tactic. I'll make you scared of something that's different.
Emily Clancy ending that report by Mark Lowen in Italy. There's confusion surrounding a claim by a notorious hacking group that they've accessed personal details of more than 500,000,000 people who use the US website Ticketmaster. Shiny hunters, who've been linked to a string of data breaches in the past, are demanding a ransom. But Ticketmaster, which operates a massive ticket sales platform, hasn't commented. So, what's happening? Lizzie Hocking spoke to Nigel Fair, a professor of cybersecurity at Australia's Monash University.
It's an interesting one. We've got the hackers saying there's about 560 million records that they've got access to and they've got them for sale for US$500,000. But on the other side of the coin, we've got the organisation saying nothing. So we don't know how to verify that claim. I think it's interesting that the fact that the organisation has said nothing, if they had nothing to hide, then you'd sort of sell them otherwise.
There have been a lot of people, though, Nigel, out there who are going to be really worried that they might have been hacked. What can they do?
Oh, substantially. And it's really hard because we use these platforms in good faith and we assume these big platforms are going to keep our personally identifying information safe and secure. So the relationship between the consumer and the platform is really out of skew. So essentially all people can really do is be hypervigilant. They can monitor bank statements. They can monitor unusual SMS phone calls, emails for any phishing attacks and just try and be as good as they can online.
Because, Nigel, is this kind of thing becoming more and more common? It feels that way, but is that what's happening?
It certainly is what's happening. We're seeing large-scale data breaches, monthly, smaller-scale data breaches weekly, if not daily, all impacting on the trust, the safety and the confidence of internet users.
Nigel Fair, a professor of cybersecurity. Coming up in this podcast, we speak to people from small businesses in the United States who are feeling the impact from the Baltimore Bridge collapse.
I've gone back to working a second job, and man, it's hard, dude. I'm tired.
This year, 2024, is an historic election year with politicians vying for power in some 50 countries. More than 2 billion voters either have already or will be heading to the polls in countries including the United States, India, Mexico, and South Africa. And here in the UK, the general election has been called for July the 4th. So we'd like to try to answer your questions ahead of the vote. Whether you are a Brit living abroad or a World Service listener here in the UK. So please email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
As we record this podcast, and with counting very much still underway, early projections in South Africa's general election suggest that the ruling ANC has lost its majority in the key province of KwaZulu-Natal to the MK opposition party led by the former president Jacob Zuma. Sile Ngubane is MK's secretary general.
It shows that what we've done, we mean business. The numbers will start to trickle in. And what's our expectation when we are campaigning? We are campaigning for a two-third majority. Because our aim is to change this constitution of this country that is oppressive to our people. Ours, we are driven by the mandate of the people to free them from the oppression of the capitalist agenda where it's extrapolating the economy of the South Africa and move it somewhere else and not benefiting the people of this country.
Projections suggest that the ANC is also likely to fall short of the vote share it needs to remain in office without coalition partners. Our correspondent Barbara Pletusher is in Johannesburg.
Around 19 voting districts have been counted so far. The ANC is leading with around 43%. The main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, has around 25%. It's the pro-business party that has its stronghold in the Western Cape. And then there are these two other parties that are led by former ANC figures, which are left-wing rivals to the ANC now. You mentioned the MK party for the former President Jacob Zuma. That's around 8%. And then there is the Economic Freedom Fighters, which advocate nationalization of mines and banks and things like that. They're around 9%. So that's the sort of map that we have at the moment.
If the ANC loses its parliamentary majority, I mean, what might a coalition government look like?
You know, that's going to depend very much by how much the ANC would lose support. So if it would have been just a small amount, then it could have made a coalition with some of the smaller parties and make less concessions. But if the projections are correct, it would have to make a coalition with one of the bigger parties, which are the rivals of the ANC. So the Democratic Alliance would be one option, but they are really seen, they've struggled to shake their image as the party for the white minority, and it would be quite unlikely for the ANC to look to them for a coalition partner. That would leave the other two that I mentioned, the Economic Freedom Fighters and or the MK, but there would be quite a lot of intense negotiations and trade-offs in order to get something like that to work.
And it does mean a huge change for the country, doesn't it? Because the ANC has been in power since, what, 1994?
Yes, exactly. It's had an absolute majority. It's been the single dominant party for 30 years. So this would be quite a dramatic evolution in the democracy of South Africa to have a coalition government at the national level. Now, coalition governments at sort of lower levels, provincial or municipal, have not been particularly successful. But certainly the voting turnout and the things people were saying strongly suggested that the South Africans wanted a change, and perhaps they feel that maybe a coalition would help them to keep their leaders more accountable. Having said that, there aren't any easy options for a coalition, so if there is going to be one, it will probably lead to some political volatility in the coming weeks.
Barbara Plett in Johannesburg, and final results are expected over the weekend. A mayoral candidate in Western Mexico has been murdered at his closing campaign event ahead of elections this weekend. Alfredo Cabrera was about to address his supporters at a final rally when he was shot in the head, prompting panic in the crowd. Here's our South America correspondent, Will Grant.
The killing of a local candidate for mayor in Coyuca, just outside Acapulco, is another reminder, if anyone needed, of just how bloody this election campaign has been. Alfredo Cabrera of the opposition coalition, called Strength and Heart for Mexico, was greeting supporters and about to step onto the stage to close his campaign when a gunman shot him in the back of the head. The murder was captured on mobile phone footage which has been posted online. In the video, a series of around 15 shots can be heard, and state authorities later announced that the gunman had been shot at the scene. Mr. Cabrera's coalition condemned the killing on social media, urging the authorities to investigate the crime and apprehend those responsible. They also blamed the ruling party, Morena, for, as they put it, not having made even the most minimal effort to guarantee the safety of the candidates in this campaign. The killing came on the final day of what has been the most violent election in modern history in Mexico. Earlier, the front-runner for president, Claudia Sheinbaum, closed her campaign in the centre of Mexico City, urging her supporters to make history on Sunday. She's hoping to become Mexico's first woman president. Ms. Sheinbaum, a former mayor of Mexico City, has run on a platform of continuity with President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's social policies. But opponents have criticized Mr. López Obrador for failing to bring the country's dire security situation under control.
Will Grant. It's been 2 months since the collapse of the Key Bridge in Baltimore in the United States, and the deadline to unblock the port's shipping channel is imminent. The government has given a loose promise to make it happen by the end of May, but there are doubts that deadline will be met, causing more disruption to the local and global economy. Izzy Greenfield from Business Daily has been finding out how small businesses have been affected.
The Port of Baltimore is a very important port for supply chains globally, within the U.S. obviously, but also it does have global impact as it's a major port of entry, both import and export, to the United States.
Chloe Domrovsky is the president and founder of Edgewood Insights. She's an expert in risk, resilience and sustainability.
It's not the biggest, but it is a really key port for certain types of products. Those are automotive, importantly, automotive, trucking, heavy machinery, because it's what's called a roll-off, roll-on port, which means that they can easily bring these ships right into the port and they can roll off these giant products, the automotive, the trucking. And so that's a really key, and not every port can accommodate that. It's also a key strategic port for a lot of commodities. So it does impact a lot of different types of products, both finished products and commodities. I mean, this port is directly responsible for 15,000 jobs within the city of Baltimore, but indirectly for 140,000 jobs. To put that in context, that's 50% of Baltimore's workforce.
Jennifer Pruitt is the co-owner of TP Transportation Baltimore, which operates out of the port. When the bridge collapsed, how quickly did it impact your business?
We have about 30 drivers who do container and rail work out of the Port of Baltimore and off the rail. After the first week, pretty much shut us down. We had no work after the first week coming out of Baltimore, and the next closest port for us to work out of was Norfolk, Virginia. But our drivers weren't set up to work out of Norfolk, Virginia. So, and then the next issue was we had no containers going from here to Norfolk. So the first part of our trip was basically for free. We had to go to Norfolk to get the loads.
And how are things now?
Things are still not good. Some freight is slowly coming out of Baltimore due to being barged in, and they have made a point to give it to us if they can give it to us. So I'm hopeful in the future that our workload will get back to where it was.
Those in trucking aren't the only people affected. One of those businesses is this one.
I'm Captain Bobby LePen from Boat Baltimore. So my wife and I run Baltimore's only exclusively private sailing charter. We're locals. We live in Baltimore. We run our business out of Baltimore, doing 4 2-hour sailing charters each day from South Baltimore out to the bridge and back. That's always been our route, even before the bridge collapsed, to sail out to the bridge and back. It's still just strange that the skyline has just dramatically changed.
So business is down 23%. How is that affecting your life right now?
So it's like sad. So I've gone back to working a second job. We're just running the boat on Tuesdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, which allows me Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday to basically work a job to raise money to run a business on the side. And man, it's hard, dude. I'm tired.
U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged that the federal government will pay the full cost to rebuild the bridge. And for the thousands of workers and businesses impacted, temporary relief programs have been put in place. The US Department of Housing and Community Development has authorized the Neighborhood Business Works program to provide $15 million in grants and no-interest loans to eligible businesses.
Izzy Greenfield reporting. Baseball, one of the most popular sports in the United States, is trying to, in its words, right an historic wrong. Because of racism and segregation, black players were banned from competing in the major leagues. That changed back in 1947 when Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he became a legend.
Robinson dashes to the plate. It's close, and umpire Summers calls him safe on the daring maneuver. But Yogi Berra doesn't think so. And the fans will never forget the sight of Jackie Robinson preparing for the plate on his daring steal.
Well, before 1947, for nearly 30 years, African Americans played in separate leagues. Their achievements have now been recognized by including the statistics from that era in Major League Baseball's official history. So, why has it taken so long? Alex Ritson asked our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Change has been a long time coming, hasn't it? You mentioned Jackie there breaking the colour barrier back in 1947. That despite the fact that it wasn't until, 22 years later that a committee was established to determine which of the so-called Negro leagues should have their scores incorporated into the official record. And another 50-plus years before the death of an unarmed black man, George Floyd, at the hands of a white police officer on the streets of Minneapolis, provided the impetus for Major League Baseball to set up a committee made up of historians and researchers and statisticians to survey the records of 2,300 players in order to incorporate them into the record books. It proved a painstaking and a prolonged process, Alex, not least because the leagues had fewer resources back in the day. Their statistics weren't kept in a single place. And so the researchers had to dig through decades of newspaper archives and other sources to dredge up the scores from nearly 30 years of games. And bearing in mind that we are talking between 60 and 80 games in a typical season, as well as exhibition and all-star games, it was quite an undertaking, as you can imagine.
Yeah, and this means that several records have now changed.
That's right. The findings have overturned several records that were previously attributed to white baseball players such as Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and Willie Mays. And they've underlined the astonishing achievements of African-American players such as Josh Gibson of Pittsburgh's Homestead Grays, who, as a result of this reevaluation, has now replaced Ty Cobb as the holder of the record for the highest batting average in U.S. baseball history. Unlike some other African-American players, Alex, he never made the move to Major League Baseball, but he now heads the record tables in several other categories, supplanting even the legendary Babe Ruth of the New York Yankees, who was long hailed, of course, as the greatest player in baseball history in one of those categories. All that some 77 years after Josh Gibson's death.
David Willis. And finally, one of the world's biggest artists. I don't know if I could ever go without watermelon sugar. Harry Styles, of course, who grew up in a tiny village in England. Now, Holmes Chapel has decided to organise guided walking tours, including a visit to the bakery where Harry worked as a teenager, to help cope with the thousands of fans who are descending on the area. Our culture reporter, Noor Nanji, has had a preview.
Harry Styles is one of the biggest pop stars on the planet. Starting in One Direction before launching a successful solo career.
So tell me a bit about you.
I work in a bakery.
What do you do in the bakery?
I like serve the cakes in like the shop.
Okay.
He shot to fame on The X Factor. Isn't she lovely? Since then, the village where he's from has become a must-see for fans known as Harry's.
Due to the weather today, the walk down to the viaduct itself will be quite muddy and challenging. So we have
now people visiting Holmes Chapel are being offered a new walking tour.
A little fun Easter egg for you. To your right, just there behind those green metal gates, is Harry's Primary School, Hermitage Primary School.
The tour guides faced a competitive process to get the job.
I'm Gillian. I'm from New Jersey in the US.
And why are you giving a tour of Harry Styles' hometown?
I've been a fan of his for 14 years, and I saw this job, and I live in Manchester now, and I just thought it was my dream job, and I had to do it and give it a shot.
And you're 16 years old. Why are you giving a tour like this?
Well, I personally think that due to me being a similar age of Harry when he first broke to fame, I think me giving this tour represents how young he really was when he took such a big step in auditioning for The X Factor.
So you hired Harry Styles when he was just a teenager. What was he like?
He was a really nice lad, just so easygoing, such a pleasure to have working for me, so nice with the customers.
Did he turn up on time?
Yeah, his timekeeping was fine. Yeah, no problem at all.
How long have you been a fan?
Since about 2010. So since One Direction started.
Pretty much half your life?
Way more than half, yeah.
I've never had anyone to really go with, so it's really exciting coming here and doing the tour.
Other stops on the tour include the Twemlow Viaduct, where the singer had his first kiss. It's also where he famously wrote his name in the One Direction documentary, This Is Us. And fans have now covered Harry's wall with their own messages to him. Behind it all, there's an important safety message. In the past, fans made their way to the viaduct using this road, but locals say it's dangerous. By taking visitors in another direction, on a traffic-free route, tour organisers hope to keep them safe. Back at the viaduct, and I couldn't go without leaving my own heart.
Fan and reporter Noor Nanji. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.